click on the podcast help link at archive.kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch means it's Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for the Always Alive, So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston that is devoted entirely to storytelling, where tellers from greenhorns to aces take us on astounding journeys with profound personal narratives, enchanting folk tales, and every conceivable kind of yarn in between. Only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubichek, Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Houston Downtown, with Roxy Russell and Shannon McCurchy, who's a little under the weather tonight. We hope she's okay, and she'll be back next week. A legion of great folk tellers have graced this studio, whose animated styles prompted even the most somber listener to smile, even laugh extemporaneously, in the open, in front of people, no less. Because this kind of communicator can capture any audience, people who hang on the teller's every magical word and descriptive gesture. This type of storyteller is seated next to me right now. However, Scott Bumgardner does a lot more. He delivers a collection of family tales that reinforce what writer Sue Monk Kidd declared about the value of telling family stories. Stories have to be told or they die. We can't remember who we are or why we're here. Scott always knew this as he peppered in a few extraordinary yarns about his family in his first guest appearance on this show in August of 2008, when it was a monthly open journal. And in 2008, I think he did a great job. And from that on, I think he did a few more visits until the most recent, when he was a real sport, when he reported to KPFT on a Monday morning at 5:15 a.m., June 17th of 2013, when So What's Your Story aired Monday at 6 a.m. And I think he was the only one old enough to be up, and that's why he came here. My God, it was an old crowd. Youngins are not up that hour, Scott. No way. But tonight, he's going to tell and talk about how we gather family stories. You know, on Scott's Texas legacy, which he's going to talk about a little bit later, he says, I began writing cowboy-type poetry and stories in 1990 when his horses fell on him, breaking his pelvis. His stories from folklore to family are exactly what we'd expect from a great teller. Signature style, superb skill set, all apply to a significant repertoire. He was elected as the president of the Texas Folklore Society, what he's most proud of, and for good reason. He was lassoed into being the president of our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, several times over, I think for like 30 years. I don't know if there's any other president. And two-time champion of the Louisiana Liars Contest. He is a retired HPD officer, dedicated storyteller, and someone I'm proud to call a friend. Scott, how are you?
I'm doing great.
And, you know, you're a favorite here. You've been here forever, and I really do appreciate it. You know, tonight you're going to be telling the truth, at least truthful stories with a dollop of a little amplification, because even our family stories has a little bit of folklore in it. But
Speak for yourself,
yeah,
Hank.
Well, I know. Well, my family, you got to lie about it and make them interesting because they're all a little nuts. But because of your penchant for the tall tale, you are equally talented as a liar. Right? Gator festivals, outlandish cowboy yards, a few stretched versions of the rodeo. But tonight it's all about family, and lying and truth is a little bit different. Is there one type of story that you find easier than another? A truthful story or a tall tale? Tough question, I know.
Truthful stories are a little bit easier. In tall tale, you really just have to open your mind up and let your imagination run wild. Yeah. And truthful story, you want to get it pretty much right, yeah, especially if some of the participants might be there to hear it.
Right. You know, and I know that one of your expertise is to deal with oral histories, which is really a very important cultural phenomena. And the truth is that I like doing oral histories, and I find what you say is absolutely correct, because when you talk about your families, you really have to maintain the dignity of all the parties. You're concerned about accuracy and precision. A little bit of amplification on the positive side is okay, right? But on the other side, it doesn't work out too well. But tonight, you've got some great stories for us, and it's sort of a way of entering the holiday season, in a way, because holiday stories and family stories are inextricably related to each other. Jay Staley, a friend of ours from the Guild, is often here around the family time and holiday time, and he's always talking about family stories. And I think it's really a theme that we ought to start delving into a lot more. And why don't you go ahead and tell us one, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you collect family stories. But get us started.
Well, I'll get you started with a story from my dad's teenage years. My father was raised in Abilene, Texas, in the height of the Depression. He was born in 1923, and he is still kicking, believe it or not, at 91 years old. Not kicking very hard, but he's there. But this is a story I finally pried out of his mind and remembrances, and we put it down in a little book. But in the height of the Depression, these kids had nothing. He was a young man. His family had broke up, and they were all piled into his grandma's house, he and several other family members. In fact, my grandmother and dad lived in the dining room, of all things, because times were hard. So, obviously, with this crowded situation, Dad found time away from home. One day, he and one of his buddies, Don Coffey, were down near 2nd Street where the train came through Abilene, and one of those trains had stopped right there, blocking a few of the streets through Abilene, and Don looks over at Dad and says, "You know, we ought to jump on this train and go out to California. Find us some work." Because there certainly wasn't any work in Abilene in those days. And Dad said, "Oh, well, I don't know. I probably should tell my mother, but no, she wouldn't let me go. Let's do it." The next thing you know, those guys climbed on top of a boxcar, and off they went. It was the Texas and Pacific Railroad. They got to El Paso eventually and changed onto a Southern Pacific train and headed to San Bernardino, California, where they ultimately ended up. And it was a long and hard trek. You're sitting up on top of a boxcar in the middle of summer. This was the year prior to his sophomore high school year, and you've got to maintain your balance. You're going to fall off. You get sleepy up there. You're liable to fall off. In fact, at one point, Dad used his belt to help kind of tie him on so he'd have a warning if he started slipping off. And another problem they ran into, sometimes those boxcars would have one wheel, that big old metal wheel, would have a little flat spot on it. Maybe that train hit its brakes too hard and locked up the wheels. And that train car would just go bump, 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 constant jumping in your body. Like if you had a big bubble on your tire, that car would be jumping a little bit, except there's no cushion. Sitting on top of that boxcar, he said it just make you nauseous. So then you have to get up and precariously walk down to another car and get on that. And every now and then, a whole bunch of soot and stuff would come out of the chimney of that locomotive up ahead. And he couldn't quite figure it out, but it was just turning them black with dirt. And later, one of the hobos that he ran across, that's one of the homeless people, as we call them these days, but he knew them as hobos, said they would force some sand through that smokestack to clean it out, and that sand would come back there and pepper all these guys. And at this time in our history, he wasn't the only one riding the car. They finally got over there into California, and that train stopped to take on some water. And he and everybody else on the cars ran off to this body of water. It was the Salton Sea. And the engineer was nice enough to wait once he got all his water for those guys to come back. He tooted the horn, and here goes Dad and all those other guys running, dressed, undressed, naked, back to that. They arrived at San Bernardino, and there was work ready for them. Kind of that shovel-ready work, you might say, but it was wheelbarrows of concrete. He and Don worked building the foundation of a school, toting loads of concrete. But they hit the high life soon. Don had been a caddy at a country club in Abilene. He said, let's go find a country club. And they went up into the Chino area outside San Bernardino and found this really big country club. And they found a couple of guys there and said, hey, can we caddy for you? And Dad said he carried two golf bags on his shoulders for 18 holes.
Wow.
And he made more money that one day of working as a caddy than his mother would make back in Abilene in an entire week, which was really amounted to $7 at that time. She was making $1 a day working at the creamery there in Abilene, wrapping ice cream sandwiches. Well, he and Don continued doing that job for a while, and they explored California. Dad saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time and thought it would be great to jump in it until he found out that it is 50 degrees or so, even in the summertime. Well, their little trek out there and their time eventually was about over, so Dad started thinking about jumping the train and coming back to Abilene. He said, well, Don, you know, we got to go back and finish our high school years and such. And Don said, no, I like it out here. I'm going to stay. And that was the last time Dad ever saw Don Coffey again. Maybe one of his relatives in the Houston area now, and we'll hear this.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing time, totally different than things that we can imagine this day and age.
And that doesn't sound very profound, but it really is. There are things that are unfathomable that our parents experienced that we can't imagine. I mean, I'm sure that people right now under the age of 30 are thinking, $1 a day? Really? Really? Yeah. I mean, my God, it was incredible. My first job, and I'm not that old. I'm a little older than you, but not by much. But my first teaching job was $9,200 a year in 1976. That was top salary. That would be totally laughable now. But you know what? It went a lot further. Amazing. You know, this is Hank Rupacek with Roxy and Shannon, and you are listening to guest teller Scott Bumgardner with Family Whoppers on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston or KPFT.org if you're listening online. But whatever channel you chose, we are glad you did. Scott, you composed a book of stories about your dad, and I know you've told many stories about family members, your grandmother, I believe, you know, I remember.
Yes.
That one about the car and great story. But your dad seems to me to be really special. What made him so story worthy?
Well, his memory, even at 91 years old, is phenomenal. I mean, he can remember minute details and the names of all these folks and the places that he'd been. I am not like that. I might have met a whole mess of people a week ago. I might have spent a whole week doing some kind of work with them. And a week later, their name is not necessarily going to be on the tip of my tongue. So getting with him and getting the details, well, that involved a lot of arm twisting. Family was always pretty private about their past and how things went. And he didn't really have in his mind the joy and such of growing up that so many of us do. I mean, it was a hard road. He never went hungry. Mm-hmm. Family always had food because they were from a farming background, and they would plant an entire farm in their backyard, so to speak.
Right.
Even when I was a teenager, Grandma had chickens in her backyard over there in town in Abilene. Getting him to actually sit down and start breaking down these stories, that was the hard part. And I actually got him to write them, and then I've had to go over them and edit them such, and then find out and fill in some gaps in the information.
I know he's alive and kicking. Do you ever tell him these stories? He's aware that you've written stories about him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, the funniest thing, he never had an interest in going back to Abilene until Someone told him about the 50th high school reunion. Well, then he's the class of, yeah, well, 40 and 41. He kind of spanned 2 years mm-hmm. there, but mm-hmm. He graduated mid-year in 41 and went straight into the Marine Corps before Pearl Harbor or anything. Right. But he never had an interest in going home until he heard about this, and that sparked something wow. in him. Mm-hmm. He's been every year since until recently. This year, in fact, was the first year he didn't go because his health and honestly, most of their friends have mm-hmm. died off mm-hmm. over there.
Sure, sure.
He not only went to his reunion every year, mm-hmm. he started celebrating his birthday. You know, we'd be saying, Dad, are we going to have a birthday party? No, I'm going to Abilene's to see my friends.
God bless him. That's great. You know, we're going to get to another story in a second, but just a few seconds. Give us some ideas about how you collect stories. And I ask because I have some questions here that I and you can comment on these, that I ask people when I find about them and their stories. I ask things like, you know, what's the origin of your name? My name? What were you ever named someone else? Were any of these names of your ancestors changed when they came to this country? What kind of mysteries or skeletons remain in your family's closet? That's always a good one for me because there's always something dangling around with lots of bones that I need to unfold. Who's the keeper of the flame in your life? Who do you wish to emulate? What kind of celebrations did you have in your home growing up? What was your favorite food? What kind of letters would you want to write to your family and friends? I remember having conversations with my son by showing him old report cards and stuff like that, heirlooms, photographs, things that really do serve as ignition keys. And I know you're really good about that. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that you use?
Also well, as you say, heirlooms can be the ignition mm-hmm. keys, the yeah. spark that opens some memories in someone, especially when you're talking to an older person mm-hmm. like that.
Right.
You dig around in these boxes of photographs that most of our families do have. Well, who is this? Yeah. Oh, that was my dad's yeah. mother, you know. Or,
yeah. We're going to ask Roxy in a few minutes if she has any collection of family stories because she has got a wild family. I know it because I'm part of the family. But in the meantime, tell us another story.
Well, earlier tonight, I was visiting with some of my friends from my Masonic Lodge. Boy, that ought to get the phones ringing in here. All the conspiracies, how we control the world. Golly, we hardly control our own buildings that we occupy and such. But I was over there visiting with some of the guys, and I just thought about this story. It's kind of, it's not that old, but it's almost jumped into the world of folklore. It involves one of our past masters of my lodge. My lodge is Jacques Desmalet Lodge, and this man named Ed. And Ed was with a man at that time who was a Texas Supreme Court justice. Well, Ed and the judge were heading down the road up toward North Louisiana. They were going to Shreveport, I suppose, and it was for a big Masonic youth organization called Desmalet. And they were going up there to help these kids put on a program, and they go through all these little skits and acting kind of things. But Ed and the judge are big men. And as you notice, well, folks, if y'all could see, I'm kind of a big man myself. We call it the girth of leadership that often is found within Masonry. But Ed and the judge are hauling down the road, and they start cross over the Sabine River up there into Louisiana. In one of my favorite little towns, they arrive at Natchitoches. And there's a catfish kitchen or some such restaurant there. All you can eat fried catfish. Boy. They thought that would be a mighty good lunch. And they went in this all-you-could-eat catfish place, and they ate their fill. Two big men walked out stuffed and satisfied, got in their car, and drove the rest of the way up there to Shreveport. While they're on driving up the road, they knew some friends were back home that were going to be coming up there a little bit after them. And they called down there and said, Tom, Charlie, you got to stop at this catfish kitchen up there in Natchitoches, Louisiana. Man, they have the best catfish you could ever imagine. And It's all you can eat. Woo! That sounded good to Tom and Charlie, so they went on down the road from Houston up there, arrived at Natchitoches, and found that restaurant. They were so glad, because it was coming on dinner time, and they were hungry. Oh, yeah. Two big men, ready to eat. They went in there, sat down, called the waitress over. Oh, yeah, we'll have a sweet tea here, and water here, and we know what we want already. We want the all-you-can-eat catfish dinner. And she didn't know what to say for a second. She just kind of, and she scratched her head. And finally she said, well, I'm sorry, sir. There were two big fat men in here earlier, and they ate every piece of fried catfish we have. You'll have to pick something else from the selection.
That's great. How about all-you-can-eat salad? Yeah, really, that's really what they'd want. That's great.
That is a true story.
I believe it. Roxy, you got anything that can top that one? Any kind of family stories? I know that last year we talked around the holidays. You had some interesting ones.
Unfortunately, I do not have any stories that can top that one.
But you ever collect them? You ever think about
them? Yes, I did a lot of collecting when my grandmother passed this past. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nothing quite like emptying a house out to really find the nooks and crannies.
Yeah. Was there anything in particular that you found, any memorabilia or collectible that really sparked it?
I found a lot of albums that I didn't really know existed because my grandmother was she was really into family histories, and she did the genealogy, right. And she did all of that through our side of the family. And I found a bunch of pictures of people who I had no idea existed or were. Yeah. Or related to.
I can relate to it, but my mother has a lot of photos too, and I have no idea who these people are. And it's kind of embarrassing because I'm a little older than you, and, you know, my mom's 83, my stepfather's 91, and, you know, I really would like to know a lot more, and I just don't take the time to do it, and it's embarrassing because there are things that you have to know, mm-hmm. and you have to find mm-hmm. out. And you have to take the time to do it. Collecting reminds me that Shannon, who unfortunately is not feeling well, but she'll be okay, has collected quite a following on So What's Your Story by doing some research and constructing and communicating information about our incredible guests, festivals, and storytelling news on Facebook. So please visit our So What's Your Story page on Facebook, and please like us on the way out. And speaking of liking, Roxy, we always like to talk about the Houston Storytellers Guild for all the right reason. It's the best place to listen and learn about the art of telling, because the Guild is made up of truly some of the best, most supportive and encouraging folks around. We just had our monthly swap this last Tuesday. It was raining, but we still had a pretty good turnout given the weather. Why don't you tell us, please, Roxy, if you would, where and when we meet?
The Guild meets on the third Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Multi-Service Center right across from Marshall's at 1475 West Gray.
Thank you, Roxy. It's where people vote, and we're not going to get in the way because I'm told that we're going to be there before people vote. So there. Be sure to check out our site at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for all the fun happenings like Skyline Screamers, which this year is going to be on Halloween night, Friday, October 31st at 7 o'clock at Marmion Park, 18th and Heights Boulevard. Mr. Scott Bumgarter, the gentleman here tonight, is in charge of our site, and he's doing his signature over-the-top job. He's loaded every So What's Your Story program on the site, even when the program was in its infancy stage years ago. And when you go to the site, look at the menu on the left to find radio shows. Click and hopefully enjoy. Any additional enticing words for those interested in visiting a meeting, Scott, that you can offer us?
We have funded all our meetings.
Yeah, we do.
Easy share. Of stories, yeah. You don't necessarily have to tell. In fact, my wife would, she almost gets mad at me, even if I have her stand up and introduce herself. Right. She wants to listen to these stories, not tell them.
Anne Marie very rarely says anything, but she loves coming. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad you're mentioning this, because most people think that if you are a member of some kind of organization that touts performance, like standing up and telling a story, that the biggest part is telling the story. It's not necessarily. We have a lot of members who just prefer to listen. They offer feedback sometimes, but the only way to really acquire a style is to listen to people tell stories. It's a lot like writing. You can't write well unless you read a lot of books because you have a sense of what sentences look like. And the same thing is true with storytelling. You have to listen to a lot of styles in order to really get a sense of how people sound. Next week, we're going to spotlight another, actually a request teller, someone that Roxy solicited from the Moth a few months ago. Actually, two tellers, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman. They are really a very magnetic, very alluring duo that Roxy discovered, and they're pretty remarkable, aren't they, Roxy? They really are. When they were here, Chris was a riot. You know, she's a pharmaceutical tech, and she's just. The kind of stories that she just has about drugs in and of themselves are ridiculous. And when Harwood was here, he told a very tender story about his father and about the fact that he always wanted to hold his father's hand, and he could never do it because he was afraid for some reason. And when his father was very ill, not too long before he passed, he held his hand. And ever since then, he held his hand until his father died. It was a very moving story, and I'm not really doing it justice, but I know that many evenings when we have our fun drive, Roxy plays it as one of our sample stories because it's extremely, extremely poignant. Any other ways to collect stories, Scott? You know, we talked about interviewing, and we talked about making sure that we look at heirlooms and photographs. Anything else come to mind that we should be aware of? Because, again, this really is sort of a holiday thing coming up, I think.
Oh, well, Halloween season's a good time. Halloween. And then, of course, we've got all our other good and holy days and fun holidays coming up.
Yeah.
But it's a great time as you get together with family. If you want family stories, typically you've got to spark their imagination and interest, say by a picture or one little thing you might recall. You know, tell me more about that. It takes active listening. You got to show you're interested. And if you get practice in this and start really doing well, you may even want to incorporate a digital recorder, of course, with permission of whoever you're talking to. And you know, it's one thing to have that story in your head. But how are you going to share it with your children or with friends or make it into a fun story? Even my tall tales incorporate just a touch of truth. And quite often that's about some family member or someone I've known.
Oftentimes on this show, I've talked about StoryCorps, you know, which is that national initiative that started in Grand Central Station back in 2008, I believe. And there really is a movement toward oral history, and for all the right reasons. You know, I like asking questions like, tell me about your favorite childhood memory, something really open-ended that can start a great conversation. And doing oral histories is a combination of great listening skills, interviewing skills, and storytelling. So it really does encompass a lot of good communication skill sets that most people take for granted. And I think that's a great, great way to identify it as being very valuable. Scott, tell us about your websites or how people could reach you if they want to hire you for a party or anything like that.
Very good. Well, my website is TexasLegacies.com. Texas Legacies, that's plural, .com. And I've probably got way too much information on there. Country property. I've got some poems and a story on there.
Yeah, we didn't have a chance to listen to your poems, but boy, they are terrific. They really are. And I hope we're going to get you back, and we're going to do a poetry show. How's that? You know, a family story is a gift to each generation that preserves them by remembering them and passing them on. Thank you, Scott, so much for illustrating the fabric of family narratives and for your insights on how to collect and document the only reasonable way to celebrate the immortality of the people we love with story. Scooter's up next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the evening, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. Keep loving a great story. I'm going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. I'm Dr. Hank, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Many of us turn off the news because its coverage is negative or sensationalized or it's just poorly done. Public radio's audience, as you can probably guess, is composed of people who want to hear something better, or at least who want an option in their news choices. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director and former co-director of the news department with Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz. Join me on Sunday morning when I'll be talking with Houston Oasis about news gathering, media diversity, and more. Profiled by Time magazine in August, Houston Oasis hosts the city's largest weekly free thought gathering. This event